The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
All right, so this is our first lab session for CMS 608. And for folks, who wasn't here last Wednesday, this past Wednesday? So one, two,
who was not here on Wednesday?
Yeah, and then you guys, so you weren't here. Let's see, we have some blank index cards underneath the plastic Tupperware thing. So if you can just fill in your name, your email address, or favorite board game or card game. The email address basically just gets added to the email list. Did anyone not get an email from Jason this like yesterday?
Yeah, last time.
You didn't get an email?
Nope, didn't
so. Okay, so the email basically said that there was a swap of Friday the 17th
and the
20th. So we're basically swapping the readings around. That's really the only thing, right?
And I fixed the link for Zimmerman's article.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Eric Zimmerman didn't migrate his website terribly well, so all his pictures dropped out. It's a pity, but I actually have one of his games, Sisyphite 3000. In fact, this is like before Sisyphite 3000, so the Sisyphite 2999, which is going to be the non-digital version, which is the whole point. It is actually a computer game. It's actually a pretty decent Flash multiplayer game, back in the day when Flash multiplayer games were not that common. And if you haven't played it before online, after today, especially if you had a chance to play with the card deck, try out the online version. Do a Google search for Sisyphite 3000 and try it online. Hopefully, you'll be able. There are still people playing it because you need kind of like a minimum of 5 people to be able to get a good game going.
Taken down.
Yeah.
Oh, suck. It was such a great game. Okay. Never mind. You know. Basically, what you had were you got avatar customization in that game. You could create your character, and you could you had this really cool retro pixelated look back in the time back in the day when retro pixelated stuff was not that popular yet. But the gameplay is pretty much exactly the same as what a card game has. Okay. The readings today basically covered a lot of jargon that we're going to be going through. We're going to be using a lot of that for the rest of the class. For the most part, I'm not going to go through every single one of them because you folks can read. And if we mention something and you don't get it, you can always check back there. So just remember that first chapter in Breathwaite is a pretty good glossary of terminology that we're going to keep using. But one of the big things that they ask is, what is a game? And it's one of those... Does anyone actually want to offer their pet definition of what a game is?
Go for it.
A game is something that involves players in a set of defined rules beforehand. Mm-hmm. Rules that you have to abide by, whether they be you can't go outside these limits. You have to abide by certain, you have to do certain questions, certain orders. Something that has structure that is meant for one person to go from point A to point B.
Okay. Structure, rules, limits, players, anything?
It's fun.
It accomplishes some goal.
Goal.
So you always have something kind of cool.
You're working towards something? Anything else?
It's true. Yeah. Always an abstract system, often an abstraction of some real system.
An abstract system? So these are actually pretty good benchmarks. Now that there are, again, as Brenda describes, there isn't one that's just the canonical answer for everything. It really depends on which theorist you are reading at any given time. But usually they will involve a significant subset of all of these in the definition. And I kind of like to keep things broad and vague because for the most part, If you define yourselves too strictly, it might be useful if you're an academic and you need to write papers about it. But if you're a designer and you're just trying to create something fun, the word I would prefer to use is engaging, because you know fun means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Engaging, you know, basically means that this is going to be something that you're going to want to do for a while. That is motivating. It might be terrifying you out of your wits, you know. Some people enjoy that, you know, or will really find that experience compelling, but they may not call it fun. So I
call that engagement. The problem with using fun and engaging as a metric for defining what a game is that means that a bad game is not a game. A game that fails to achieve fun, that fails to be engaging, you know, is not a game. But I wouldn't go that far. Largely because that means a lot of the stuff that I've created is not a game. it should give you there is no magic point where your game becomes, where the thing that you're building becomes fun and then suddenly it becomes a game. You know, I can imagine someone making that argument. It's like, it's not a game until it's fun. But I much rather sort of say, fun engagement is kind of more of a metric of how well designed your game is, not necessarily whether your game is a game. But that is a goal of a game designer, to try to create an engaging experience, something that people are going to want to do. I know some game designers who think that is not in fact their job. Their job is to maximize revenue, for instance. especially if you work in social games, there's a lot of discussion now in how business and game design is basically just one thing now. You know, the whole point of game design is, how do we get people to pay a little bit more? Zynga is going to be on town, by the way, on September 30th, and they're giving a talk. So that has those 2 points. So I will sort of coordinate this out as something that you're working towards. But all these other things, you know, a game should have players. Again, I don't want to be too strict on that, because I've certainly seen games that play themselves. And anyone here involved in Battle Code? That game pretty much plays itself, right? I mean, you set it going and then one side wins, but no, there's no human person, at least during the time when the game's actually being played. Or you could argue that the whole course of Battle Code, for those people who don't know, it's this IP course, I believe, where Core 6 students basically write bits of AI to play a real-time strategy game against some other team's AI. And the basic idea is that, you know, if you win a real-time strategy game, your AI wins, but there's no human actually playing it at a given time. But of course, there are humans writing the AI. So if you think of the entire class as a game, then there are players, there are people. I have certainly seen people make a case that there are games that are zero player. And I've heard, for example, there's a game out there called Gnomic, which is largely a game about coming up with rules. And there is a system which are actually in the rules themselves about how you change rules, and of course those rules themselves can be changed, and that changes the way how you change rules. And by the time you actually play the game, someone's already won, because somebody in the game has no legal moves. That's the whole game. It's basically making it impossible for someone else except for you to win. So does that game actually have players? Well, yes, it does, because you guys are arguing over all the rule changes, you know, and through the rules of the game. But in a sense, it had no players because the game never actually got played. The rules are basically stating, you know, this is an unplayable game for everybody, but except for one person in who's playing the game. Goals are one of those things that I used to be very, very adamant about. Like a game had to have a goal. You have to know what you're going towards, and if you don't have that, then it's a toy or something. You know, it's a dollhouse, it's an experiment. The Sims was the one that I was like railing about when I was an undergraduate. You know, that's not a game. And of course, I was working with many colleagues, and eventually came over to the site that it doesn't matter whether I think it's a game or not. If it's in the game shelf of Best Buy, it's a game. So, because people think it's a game. And if enough people think it's a game, then it might as well be a game. You know, because otherwise, because that's what people think it's going to be. So when you come up with your game, I would say that goals are one of those things that helps steer player behavior. So, and it's one of those tools that you have as a designer to basically say, this is important, this is not. Reaching the end of 100 meters is important for a sprinter. That end is really not interesting for, you know, somebody who's running 400 meters or a 50-meter dash. But that gives someone a direction for them to go towards. But there are plenty of games where you have to invent your own goals. Other than Sims, anyone can think of any? Where inventing your own goals is kind of the fun.
MMORPGs.
A lot of MMORPGs have that. They have goals, they have quests, but you know that's not where a lot of the fun is.
Second Life,
a lot of virtual worlds.
A game like Eve?
You have to set your own goals, right? Because whatever's in the game is only good enough for like a single player to tell whether a single player whether they're doing well or not. But Eve is not about a single player. Eve is about thousands and thousands of people playing simultaneously. Have people heard of Eve? Okay. All right. So yeah. Cool.
I stopped the development.
Oh, cool. In Iceland?
Yeah.
Was it like really cheap when you went over there?
Yes.
Could you have bought the entire studio?
No.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
It was really cheap.
Yeah.
Like,
so they must have been making tons of money.
Yeah.
Because they're making money in US dollars and in euros.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. They probably hire support most of the economy.
Probably
that
most of
the
Icelandic economy.
Yeah.
The capital is 20,000 people, so really
So I would say goals are very important tools, and as a result of that, you see them in a lot of games. And you know, for most of the games that you guys are going to be building, you're going to give a very clear goal of this is what you want to do: earn a certain amount of money, prevent your opponent from doing anything else, you know, take over all of the land, that sort of thing. Let's see. Well, I'll get to rules last. Systems. I might already have mentioned this in the last class, but games are systems in a way that most MIT engineers would think of systems. You know, they're a bunch of interconnected little modules, all of them with sort of predictable behavior, and then you put them into a big interconnected system, and it is no longer really all that predictable anymore. At least that's the kind of games that we're interested in this class. There's also the game theory games, where like, the whole point of it is trying to predict what could possibly happen. Those are great thought experiments, and there's some really, really interesting math behind all them and some interesting rules of thumb that can come out. But for the most part, we aren't going to go into too much detail about that, largely because I'm not a mathematician or economist, so I don't really have a good sense of game theory. Just be aware that, you know, there is this whole field of game theory in economics. If you're doing a game like an auction system, if you're doing a game where people are doing either a lot of simultaneous moves or the whole point of the game is trying to predict what strategy your opponent is going to do, you might actually want to read up a little bit of game theory. If nothing else, just to give you some vocabulary to talk about it with your teammates, and some tools to be able to think through some of the design problems that you've got. And we do have one session where I'll introduce some of that. And finally, we're getting to rules. The things that give your game structure, and you know the constraints of the things that you can't do. You can't move from here to there without having your foot tied to another player. You know, that sort of constraint, or a rule being, you know, you can't say anything during a certain part of the game. There are two bits of terminology introduced by Brenda and Ian Schreiber in their book, which is core mechanic and core dynamic. So before I'm going to go into core mechanic and core dynamic, I'm going to talk about mechanic and dynamic. Anyone want to throw out a definition of mechanic?
It's sort of the actions like a player takes during a game, like the physical actions he takes.
Okay, the actions that a player decides to take.
Decides to take.
So actions.
Sorry if this is a little low.
I saw Patrick and oh, did those hands just go down? I thought I saw a few more hands. So.
Actions that are sort of designed by the game designer.
Okay.
So intended actions.
Design is definitely a good point. A game mechanic is definitely something that you as a game designer control. There are, you know, if a player decides to do something in the game that you did not explicitly think about, and you did not explicitly say, all right, this is what players are going to be doing in a game, then it might not actually be a mechanic. It might be something that you're discovering in your playtesting that you will turn into a mechanic, but because it's not designed, it's kind of... It becomes more like a strategy, actually, like an immersion strategy. Sorry, you were saying, Jeremy?
Is it more like a dynamic?
Possibly. There are times where it is. Yeah, yeah. Actually, let's throw out some definitions of dynamic. What do people... well, Jeremy?
Behavior that emerges from mechanics.
Okay, so it emerges, emergent behavior. What else?
Use of mechanics that isn't directly stated in the rules of the game.
Okay, so unstated.
I'm running out of space here. Okay. I thought I saw a hand on this side. No? Okay. All right, so dynamics are basically interactions of mechanics. You know, it's like you don't have anything that may necessarily explicitly say, you know, because of this one rule and because of one this other rule and because of the things that the players can do in that, you know, a good strategy is to do something else. So let me see whether I can think of an example. Right now, everything that's coming to my head is StarCraft.
Has that been the case for the past few weeks?
Unfortunately, yes. By the way, if anybody is playing StarCraft, I need testers. Because
two or StarCraft 1?
Two.
Yes.
I need testers for a map that I'm designing. Especially Zero.
Yeah,
so
I
play Zero.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There's a good example in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Right. So there's this role selection mechanic where everybody picks the thing which they want to happen during the turn, and they get a bonus for doing it. And also, everybody chooses to build particular crops.
Mm-hmm.
And the dynamic that emerges from the sequence of play, which goes clockwise, is that it's best to optimize your strategy so that you are doing so that you are benefiting from the role that the person to your right is most likely to choose, but you're making the goods that the person to your left is most likely to want to ship or sell. So the mechanic is role selection and turn order, and then the dynamic is the strategy which emerges out of that.
Which gives you some idea of what to select, as opposed, you know, the mechanic is you can select.
Yeah.
The dynamic is here are a couple of strategies that you can use in sort of assessing what will be best to select. And if all the players start to understand that, then it almost becomes like a, you know, like a second layer of rules almost. And if anyone's played a game like Bridge, for instance, there's actually a ton of things that are assumed in the play which are not actually in the rules of Bridge when it comes to bidding. Like when you call out a bid, it's highly dependent on what you actually have in your card in your card hand, and that's not actually written in the rules anywhere. But the assumption is that there is optimal way to do it, and since there is optimal way to do it, everyone's expected to know those optimal ways. The example in the book was chess moves. Like, you know, every single piece of chess has a set of moves that it can perform, right? Pawns go one or two squares depending on whether they're starting. That bishops move diagonally. But there are also opening gambits. There are opening gambits that are that are also well known, at least among professional chess players. And the idea being, oh, this person is using this opening, therefore, if I counter it with this response, I actually have a reasonable chance of actually winning this game. And professional chess players know this. The other thing that comes up in chess, which is not in the book, is there is the concept of threatened squares. If you move, if there is a square where there is no piece on a chessboard, everyone here knows the rules of chess, more or less, yeah. So say you've got a bishop, and you know, this is my very simple chessboard, and you've got a bishop, and it can move like that, right? So every single square along these lines is threatened. It's something which the bishop could move to, unless of course it's blocked by a pawn or something. Then these are no longer threatened. But the pawn is. If you're a knight, obviously it's no longer straight lines. It becomes specific, sort of like a weird stochastic pattern of squares that become threatened, but the idea of here's this square now that nobody dares move into until something's done about that bishop. Either something gets moved in its way, or something takes out that bishop or forces the bishop to move by threatening it instead in a way that it cannot respond. So threatened squares is not a rule in chess, but it greatly shapes your decision making, and that's the difference between dynamic and mechanic. There's a lot of strong correspondence between mechanics and rules, but I had a long little rant about exactly what the difference is between mechanics and rules, and what I basically, I'm not going to give the rant right now, but it's like overlapping Venn diagram. There's a very, very large area where it's exactly the same thing. My general rubric for you, for trying to figure out whether something is a mechanic or not, is whether this is the thing that changes the state of the game. If it's an action, if it's something that someone's going to be doing to change the state of what the game is, in chess, that's largely the movement of a piece. If it's ultimate, it could be just physical movement. You are limited on when you can physically move. If you have that frisbee, you're not moving. Your feet are not moving. I believe that's a rule of ultimate. The reason why I use that definition is because there are occasionally times where I need to talk about mechanics that players aren't actually doing. Like the game requires certain pieces to move in a certain way, certain things to happen in the game. In Settlers of Catan, for instance, you have these die rolls. Actually, that's not a good example, let me think. Right at the beginning of Settlers of Catan, there is the way how you set up the board. And that establishes what a game state is going to be. It changes the game state by giving you a game state in the first place. I consider that a mechanic. That is something that's going. That's not one rule. It's actually a whole collection of rules. And if you're interested in finding out what those rules are, the box is actually in that closet over there. But it's like something like five or six different rules on this is how you set up your board. It's going to set up your game state, and I consider that a mechanic. How people do bidding and buying things in Settlers of Catan, that's dynamic. There are no real rules on how much something costs. That's up to the players to work out on their own. So that's how I sort of consider the difference between core dynamic, between dynamic and mechanic. They're really, really useful concepts, because really, for the most part, as a designer, you have an idea of what kind of dynamics are interesting. And the more games that you play, the more inspiration that you get from various sources, your range of different ideas of what kind of dynamics might be interesting is going to expand. But all you have control on are mechanics, are the specific rules that you're giving your players. Note that game mechanics don't necessarily need to be written or described out. This is one thing that I think you and your teammates should figure out when you're talking about mechanics for a given project, are we just talking about the things that we're writing down? Because there are some assumptions that that are just given. We are playing a game we're playing some sort of schoolyard game or something, you know, hitting people with large solid objects is disallowed or something like that. You know, not necessarily something you need to write down unless you're playing with certain people. But you have, but you can assume that's a game mechanic there. Things like how fast, you know, people normally do things. There's a game over here called Falling, which is actually a real-time card game. It goes as fast as you can possibly play it, and there is no limit on how fast you can play these cards. But there is a real physical limit on how fast you can physically grab a card out of your hand and put it down. So actually, it's not even on your hand; you're just moving cards on the table. So make sure you give that a try today. We'll be getting to aesthetics, I think, next class?
Next class.
Yeah, okay. So, which is another thing which a game designer, in fact, which is what I would like game designers to actually spend more time thinking about, which is what is the feeling you want your player to have? As opposed to, this might be fun, you know, this might be engaging. It's like, specifically, how is it fun? How is it engaging? Is it fun as in, like, yes, victory, I have crushed all my opponents? Or is it fun as in, wow, we had a really good time together and we got to know each other really well? You know, there are games that are designed for both of those. And what is the aesthetic you're going for? You're going for something poetic, or you're going for something, you know, fiercely competitive, tournament competitive, or you're going for, you know, just a nice little social experiment. Core mechanics and core dynamics are a tool, again, for designers. The idea of, there really isn't a huge difference between what's a core mechanic and what's just a mechanic, except inside a designer or a design team's discussion. The idea of having a core mechanic is you identify this is what our game's about, or a core dynamic mean this is what our game's about. And a lot of core mechanics in first-person shooters is pointing and shooting. Right, I'm going to point at something and I'm going to launch a projectile that way, and that projectile is going to move into some physical properties. You know, maybe it arcs, maybe it goes straight. Another core, I would say that the core mechanic of Halo isn't actually that. Like core, who has not played Halo or seen someone play Halo? Okay. So, like the ID core mechanic, or I think my budgie calls it the core gameplay loop. Of Halo is you shoot at something, you take cover, you throw a grenade at it, you wait for the grenade to go off, and then you shoot it again until it dies. right? That's pretty much all you're doing for the entirety of Halo 1. Sure, Halo 2 and Halo 3 gets complicated. Yeah, you know, but they identify that. If you actually read the postmortems and if you read the talks that they've given, they say those I can't remember if it's 20 seconds or 5 seconds of gameplay which they use to describe that. I think that 5 second of gameplay is what they focused on. And if they could get every little thing in that sequence correct, they can repeat that same thing ad infinitum and you'll still be having fun. Halo 1, everyone. you know, they're kind of right. But the idea being, you know, if you've got a core mechanic, if you've got one thing in your game that someone's going to be doing over and over and over again, all your players are going to be doing over and over again, maybe it's bidding because you're making some kind of auction game. In Falling, it's and in Pit, it's transferring cards to other people. I'm trying to think of the other games that we've got here. In Sissy Fight, I would imagine is the main core mechanic would be putting down the card and everyone revealing the card simultaneously because you all take simultaneous turns. You know, make sure that's really really fun. And Yahtzee is rolling dice. You know, that's that action, that thing that you're going to be doing over and over again, has to be at least fairly engaging. Because if you can't get that right, then what happens is that that same movement that happens 30, 50 times in your game, you know, just gets the badness just gets multiplied by 30 or 50, and you don't want that. So for core mechanics, you know, I would say the thing that happens in your game the most, and you want to make sure that that part is as engaging as possible. It also gives you a rubric to say what's not a core mechanic might be in fact expendable. You might not actually need it in your game. So if you've got a problem, this game takes too long to play, this game's too hard to learn, this game's over too fast, it's too random or something, take a look at all the things that are, you know, of course make sure that your core mechanic's not the cause of the problem. But if your core mechanic doesn't seem to be the cause of the problem, that seems to be working. Something else in the game is not working, everything else is expendable. And so you can look at everything else in your game, all these other rules that you've got, and say, how does that work with the core mechanic? How does that help? How does that hurt the core mechanic? It just helps your discussion as a team, or as an individual game designer. It helps your thinking about what could we throw out, what could we keep. Similarly for core dynamic, it's, you know, it's like here's this particular particular interaction that we really really want. In Sissy Fight, is guessing what other people are going to do, I'm trying to think of other examples. I mean, like territorial space acquisition. I guess Go is about taking over territory in space. You know, if that's your core dynamic, if you say that's kind of fun, just making sure that I'm in control of space and nobody else can do anything that they want to do in a certain part of the board, that's fun. That's what I'm going for. That's my core dynamic. That's what this game is all about. Then you can look at every single mechanic, even your core mechanics, and say, is it all serving that goal? Now, there's a whole bunch of tips right at the end of chapter one of challenges for game designers about how to break designer's block. But I would say, actually, those things are just things that you should be doing all the time. Not just when you have a problem, but you should be experimenting. Things like, you know, okay, you've got a variable, you know, draw two cards every turn or something. Multiply it by two, see what it does to your game. Halve it, draw one card, see what it does to your game. You know, throw a rule out, you know. And that sort of gets you to the whole iterative design thing. Is that you don't actually, because games are systems, they're just complex little collections of seemingly simple things. You don't actually know how these changes are really going to affect your game. You may have a hunch, but until you actually play it out, you don't actually know. So the whole point of iterative design in engineering as well as in game design is that, you know, you make the change. There has to be a substantial change, and then you actually put it to the test and see what happens. This means, of course, testing, and testing takes a long time. And if you're going to be making a game that takes a long time, then your testing gets even longer. So for the first project that's going to be coming up, the assignment one, you want to be aiming for games that take really not very long to play. These games that we've got today, I'm not sure about Chaygate, but I know everything else that we've got on that table is pretty darn fast. Which means, you know, if you've got an hour with four people who've never played your game before, maybe you get through two or three rounds, four rounds of them, you know, each time maybe tweaking a rule once here and there and seeing how that changed the game. If you've got a game that takes an hour to play, and believe me, a lot of the projects that we've gotten from previous semesters take at least an hour to play, then, you know, you've got four people for an hour and they're not going to finish a single play of the game. Because by the time they finish learning your game, half your time is up. So that's the process that we would like you all to be using in your teams, in your assignments, this iterative design process. Right from the beginning, I wish I had more space, but we're going to start with brainstorming. That's actually going to be Friday the 17th, where we'll actually sort of, for folks who haven't necessarily formally learned brainstorming, we're just going to do a quick refresher. So that everyone sort of is on the same page. You learn how to do brainstorming. You come up with a basic idea of your game, and you start to identify things that could be your core dynamics. You know, you think of what sort of core mechanics could address that. Knock something up really, really quickly with the crappiest materials you can get your hands on and start playing. Since nobody in your team knows really what game you're making at that point of time, you can probably test it with your team. As soon as you do that a few times, your team becomes useless as as testers, because you already know too much about the game and what the game could have been. And you start playing it in ways that a fresh person who's never seen your game before wouldn't even consider. So you actually want to keep looking for people who've never played your game before. So the next step would be to broaden it to other teams in this class. Since everyone's going to be broken up in more or less teams of three or four, that's pretty much, you know, I'm going to take this game that we designed for a team of three or four and give it to that team of three or four, and then you play their game and, you know, give each other feedback. And that lasts for about one more session. And after that, everyone in the class is useless now. So you have to go and look for dorm mates, friends, you know, people on the street, you know, just go right ahead and try to get as much feedback as you can. There is some value in replaying, especially later on once your rules are pretty set, in that people start developing strategies, those sort of emergent behaviors, and start understanding sort of higher level play of your game, and you do want to test that. But don't let that prevent you from also testing with fresh players. Because in the end, you have to get past that initial hurdle. Anytime someone sees your game, they are going to have to learn your game from scratch at least once. And if they don't even get that far, they're never playing your game a second or a third time. So don't optimize for the people who've played your game, you know, for 4 weeks, because you really want the people who've only played it once to have a good time as well. That's not necessarily the case if you're making, you know, a huge, well-funded game based on a franchise that, you know, that's been around forever. If you're doing Halo 3 or Modern Warfare 3 or something like that, you know, then sure, you can sort of cater to the fans who've already developed these strategies and skills. But in our case, we're going after a new audience. We're going after someone who's never played anything like what you've played before. Cool. Any questions? You've been soapboxing here for a while. Jason?
So, I guess the other thing that I would add from my experience, especially with iterative design, is a big trick of it is learning to kind of distance yourself emotionally from what you're working on, because half the time you end up chucking things that you really liked. So you think, oh, this would be so great, but it's best to just remove it. It helps to think of it as putting it on the shelf for later and saying, okay, I'll deal with this later, or I can try this in another game. And on a related note, at least, I don't know about you, but I found that when games I'm designing have a problem, it's almost always fixed by removing something as opposed to adding more stuff on. Unless you're going for something I think really complex off the start, I always prefer to try and take something out and simplify it. Yeah, especially in short projects like these, it almost always works better. And in terms of testing, too, one thing, just kind of a tip that I find works is if you're designing a game that has a lot of different like paths to victory, and this is a little bit higher level, but you'll see what I mean when we get there, where if you want a game that has different viable strategies, a really good testing method is to have different people kind of play like a perfect version of that strategy. And you say, I'm going to do this strategy, or I'm always going to do X, and it doesn't matter if I think it's dumb, I'm just going to do it. Because that'll really help you find rules that are broken or find something that's overpowered. A good example would be Settlers, right? Like if you say, obviously this wouldn't work because the game is a good game, but like I'm always going to build roads. You know what I mean? Like in practice that would be stupid, but if you're, when you're designing the game, you do that kind of strategy and you just limit yourself to one action, you can really find things that are broken really quickly.
Thanks, much appreciated. Cookies. Dude, we have cookies.
Thanks to Google.
It's the Google Food Fairy. Let's see. I think after this we're just going to play games. We do have playtesting as a topic coming up later in the semester, where we'll actually sort of talk about the discipline on how you do testing. Honestly, you shouldn't wait for that class to necessarily start practicing. You know, if you, it could be as simple as just grabbing a game that you have never seen before and just trying to get a whole bunch of people to play it, and critiquing it at the same time. You know, it's like, why did I do that? Why did you do that? Why did you do that move? You know, and there are sort of practices to make sure that when it's your game, you are not sort of telling the players what they should be doing while they are trying to play the game, because that affects their play in the game in a way that biases it. But we'll get to that later in the semester. For now, you know, just be aware. The more that you're testing, the more that you're sort of tweaking your rules in between tests and then getting another chance to test and test and test, the closer you are to getting a game that's actually fun and engaging to play. And that's what we're looking for. That's the process that we expect you folks to stick in. Whether you ever get to fun and engaging, who knows? We don't know whether you're going to get there, so we're not grading you based on that. Just remember that. We're not grading you on how engaging your games are. But how well you stick to the process? Yes, absolutely. And there was a question on the forums about when do you stop, right? Did you put it up? I didn't get a chance to look too closely at it. What can you repeat?
So essentially, it's the question of, there's this iterative design process, mm-hmm. and when do you know when to sort of get out of that process?
Mm-hmm.
It's a due date. Okay, all right. That's always a good reason. But I guess, like, if you didn't have a due date, like, how would you know when to ship? Or let's say you had control over the due date. I guess part of that is you should always be iterative. Like, you should always be updating, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question is, when do you know when you have something that you can put out into, like, the world?
So the cynical answer, yeah, is that, you know, is that you wait for, you know, you have to ship, right, or you're not getting any cash. I personally think it will be sooner than you think. It's like, you know, oh, my game's almost ready, but I know there's something wrong with it. Especially when you're a student. Right now, I'm in this mode with my StarCraft maps, which is, this map is crap. I know there's something wrong with it. I have no idea what it is. Therefore, I'm going to release it. Because until I do that, I have no idea what's wrong with it. I need to get that information. The nice thing about stuff like, you know, computer games is that you can ship updates. It's annoying, but you can. But even board games and card games now have rule revisions, rule clarifications that you can release over the net. For the most part, if you are going to go professional, your publisher will tell you. And then the answer really is due date, right? You know, it's like, it's going to the presses on this date. And that's one maxim, which is game projects are never finished, they're just abandoned. You know, it's just, I can't do anything else about this because I'm out of time, ship it. But one thing that you can do to prepare for that, let me see, is there a razor around here? There's a guy who runs a blog called Lost Garden. His name is Dan Cook. He works over in Microsoft, and he talks a lot about game design, specifically about video game design. But actually, his stuff is actually really, really applicable. And he has this concept that, you know, game design or iterative game design kind of goes in this kind of cycle where this width down here is the number of features that you've got in your game. The trick, though, is that what you're really doing is you are taking, let me see if this is right. So this is all the good stuff. This is all the stuff that's not so good. And the whole idea of using iterative design is to allow yourself to the space to come up with a whole bunch of ideas, not knowing whether they're good or bad, but then also give you a gate to cut out all of the bad stuff. So at frequent periodic intervals, you have a collection of rules, of cards, of designs, of whatever consists your game, that is pretty much as good as you possibly could have made it, given the amount of time that you've got. And that could ship. So if ship date was here, you would have as good a game as you possibly could do it. If ship date turned out to be there, all of a sudden, you know, you still had the opportunity to whittle out all of the stuff that you knew was bad. So iterative design is not about let's just keep accreting more and more and more and more features. It's more about, you know, we're going to add some features and then we're going to remove the ones that don't work. And that's really, really important. So that at any given time, you're prepared to sort of release it. And as for when you actually decide that this is now ready to go out, I would repeat sooner than you think, because you need that feedback. Sometimes you don't know how a market is going to respond until you actually do it. But you can do a soft launch. So if you're doing a commercial product, you know, you can do things where we're going to release it to a few select stores and get that feedback before we go into major print run, or you know, burn 10,000 different copies of the same board game. We're going to do 200 copies and see how that does first. It gives you the opportunity to make a revision, but it's still an official release because those 200 people think that this is the final package product. That's pretty much how a lot of manufacturing industries actually work anyway. So if you think about any kind of product design, a lot of them have a sort of like trial period.
Soft drinks
you get a lot. Japanese electronics, you know, it's like you release it in Tokyo and then you release it in the rest of Japan. And sometimes it never makes it out of Japan because, you know, that initial test, yeah, it was a good product, but not enough people bought it because of these problems. So instead of releasing it to the world, we're going to make version 2. And maybe that will be the one release to the world. That's one example. All right, so we have games.
wait, who has not played Uno?
Okay, all right. We have more games than we have. Okay, so Jason, you're going to do a Euchre table. So
like just a four-player trick-taking game, kind of in the vein of Hearts, Spades, or Bridge.
Looks like we have exactly four people. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. Oh no, we have an average of 3 people for the table. That table is 4. I think most of these games are 3 to 5 players. Although I'm going to be absolutely shocked. Yeah.
Most of this is like 4 to 8, I think.
Are you guys playing Fallen? I'll play Fallen.
Yeah. So Falling might want a slightly larger table. You guys might actually want to try the round table in the corner.
Yeah, this has the best round table.
Yeah,
4 to 8
people.
I really
want to
play Falling.
All right, let's do this. I've played Falling. I've played System.
So basically, take a game from the table. I'll bring some out and I'll see that. Play them. Once you've had a chance to play it a few times, feel free to switch and try to get as many games played as possible during the next couple of hours. Cool?